Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Cheeky Natives. This is your boy Letlhogonolo, and today we're going to do a very exciting episode actually, because you know I went to the book launch, it was amazing.
Yes.
And now we got the authors in the house. So we have obviously the resident Dr. Slay.
Hey, please don't be surprised when you see pictures of this and I look crusty in my scrubs. I am just adding a preface to this, but I was so excited to have so much black boy magic in our little studio today. We have one of the co-authors of a brilliant, brilliant new book that is called Born to Guaido, Reflections on the Guaido Generation. And it gives us so much pleasure to welcome Sihle onto the show.
Hello.
Hi,
thank
Sihle.
You for having me. How are you guys?
We're doing well. How are you doing?
Cool. Joburg traffic always sets the mood, but we're here now.
Wow.
So, yes, no, obviously, we all know, even on a Saturday afternoon,
it's
Joburg
popping.
Will show you flames.
Mm. Doesn't make sense.
I mean, Sihle, as Alma has said, obviously, this is like a brilliant book.
Mm.
But I guess, I suppose, let's start at the inception, right?
Yeah.
So, these are two people who wrote the book, so it's
yeah.
you and Essie,
yeah.
Who's unfortunately not able to join us on the podcast because she's not feeling
yeah,
well.
Yeah, she's been
But how did the connection come about? Mm. You know, how did this book come about?
Well, oddly enough, the idea started out as a podcast. So we really wanted to do a series of episodes where we talk about specific Guaido songs and speak about people's relationships with those songs.
Mm-hmm.
And during the research process, you know, I involved Essie because she has this brilliant blog called Don't Call Me Kafir. And she was really writing about Guaido from a different lens as someone mm-hmm. who didn't particularly live through it but was listening to it in hindsight.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought her perspective was quite interesting. And in doing the research for that podcast, we found that there wasn't really a definitive text around Guaido music, which was for me a surprise as a long-time fan of the genre. A lot of what's been written about Guaido music comes from the academy, and it also comes from white writers.
Mm.
So for us, it felt important to be able to write a book about Guaido music from a black perspective, but also to expand the conversation about Guaido, not to just limit it to music or it being party music, but to also speak about the politics of Guaido, as well as how it influenced other things from cinema and television to fashion. So we really wanted to open up that conversation around Guaido music a bit more.
Guaido is an interesting lens for you to have used. And I think when you go through the book, initially I was like, Born to Guaido, is this going to be another talk about millennials? You know, because
yeah.
we seem to be quite the hit. And this is a book that sort of transcends two generations, because you can see in the writing that it's two very different generations and experiences of Guaido.
Yeah.
Why did you choose to use something that people have referred to as a dead genre, right?
Yeah.
Guaido often has been killed and resurrected a million times.
Yeah.
Why did you choose to use that as a lens, particularly because it was cross-generational? So
yeah.
you were somebody who's experienced Guaido at its height and whatever, but Esinago isn't, and
yeah.
you still chose to use that lens. Why?
There's this interesting quote which I use in the book by Mike Nichols, where he says, I use my own experiences because I have no one else's experiences available to me. So for me, as a person who grew up listening to Guaido music being in my house through my uncles and my mother, it became sort of the soundtrack to everything that I've experienced and I lived through.
Mm.
And it also became something through which I'm able to see and navigate the world.
Mm.
And I think that's something that I sort of try and address in the book a lot, because you find that there are a lot of personal stories within the essays that I write in the book. So it was, and Esinako is a bit different in that she is a very much a consumer and an analyst of Guaido music, but she's also an anthropologist. So she's always looking at how does pop culture influence society and vice versa. So we come from those two very different perspectives, and we found that Guaido was an interesting lens through which we could be able to see South Africa. Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously, we'd like to give people a taste of like what the book is about. Can we ask you to read just a bit about the book, you know, so that people can get some, yes, we want to read this book.
Okay. I'm going to read from the chapter on Atamo Fukate, which is called Guaidó's Most Hideous Man. A question. In a moment, I will tell you why Atamo Fogarty is often wrongfully credited as the King of Guaidó and doesn't really deserve that title. Not simply because he's not the genre's foremost innovator. That title could go to Mdu or Espigiri. But because he represents a toxic masculinity and a co-opting of the very notion of artistic autonomy, placing him at odds with the aspirations of black excellence and joy that are at the core of the music's roots. But first, let me tell you about the exact moments I fell in love with Guaidó and how I got to the place where I had that momentous experience. In the summer of 1998, my mother and I took an hour-long drive to a remote village in the KZN Midlands called Kwahlatikulu. The village had three schools, each one designated to a different area, which at the time was under the control of the Inkatha Freedom Party. This latter fact meant that the village was still blackballed from accessing basic services such as running water and sanitation, with the ruling ANC government tying political loyalties to the provision of basic services. The village community had to walk 5 kilometers to fetch water in communal taps, and for the first time in my life, I experienced what it was like to use a long drop toilet, also known as a pit latrine. At the time, it felt like I had traveled back into the Stone Age. In the small township of Brownville, where I was born and raised, we had more civilized amenities, like the bucket system. Thinking back on this irony now, I can't help but cringe. Consciousness takes time, the writer Thando Mgqoluzana once told me.
Shoo.
Hey, I mean, for me, like, what's particularly interesting about, you know, thinking about Arthur is, like, obviously in this week that we're recording the podcast, we had the 100 Man March.
Yeah.
And that has been that debacle on social media about him coming to, well, Sunday Sun being like, Arthur, I stand
to the
behind,
forefront,
you know, these women. Yeah. And he was basically at the forefront of this 100 Men March, which was a march about gender-based violence, right? And, you know, as you speak about Arthur in the book, we know that Arthur
is trashy and
deeply.
But it also explores, and I think it's something that we just, like, it's going to depth about. You speak often about the woman in Guaidó and the hyper-masculinity that sort of surrounds these women's stories and how we want to exert some sort of agency for them, but we're not quite sure how to do it in the context of how things happen. So when you have these young women, you know, with somebody like Arthur who has the power and the privilege that comes with being where he is in the music industry, effectively grooming these young women, right? And, you know, apostrophe, because I ain't trying to get sued. But it's a very interesting topic to go into. Why did you think that it was important for you to speak about Guaidó women and hyper-masculinity and contrast those very two different identities?
Well, when we started the book, I wasn't really planning on writing about Arthur because I'm not really a fan. So there wasn't anything musically about him that interested me. Mm. But the more I thought about his story, I became obsessed with the idea of complicity. Mm. So as a society, we support this guy, we buy his album, we go to his shows. What level of responsibility do we take for the power that we give him?
Mm.
And often for me, as a person who's a consumer of art and who's worked as an art critic, it's a very difficult line to clear between the arts and the artist. Because at the end of the day, you might be able to say, well, I'm only just here for the music. But if you give a person money and you support them, you give them the resources that give them the power to be able to do bad things to other people.
Mm.
So there is a level of responsibility that you have within that. And you'll find that even in the opening of this chapter, I speak a lot about how I fell in love with Guaidó because of a moment that I saw in one of Arthur's music videos where he's having an interaction with Liberatos. And then it's about bringing that full circle into recognizing what kind of a figure he is, and really reckoning with the fact that as trashy as he is, unfortunately he is part and parcel of the history of this music that we love. And on that, for me, me and Essie had a lot of conversations, especially around the role of women in Guaidó, because in a lot of our research we found that women were writing songs that they weren't credited for. They were performing on songs that they weren't credited on. And so there was sort of this systematic erasure of the role of women in Kwaito music. I mean, even today, if we talk about some of the most innovative people in Kwaito music, we'll talk about a Mandla Spikiri, we'll talk about a TKZ, but we won't talk about a Thandiswa Mazwai. We won't talk about a Tembi Siete. People who've not only made Kwaito music, but have also transcended it. So it was important.
And continue to be relevant today.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. And that's the most interesting thing for me, because if I look back, I look at someone like a Tembi Siete, who's still a very relevant personality, who's on our TV screens every day. You look at someone like a Thandiswa Mazwai, who we all love. They have somehow been able to create a path for themselves outside of Kwaito music. I mean, you have a Nestam and a person like a Twasa who are still doing radio, you know, who are still very active. They've transcended the music in a way that a lot of the men haven't been able to. And for me, that was for us, that was an interesting conversation to be able to say, let's look more critically at the role of women in the development of Kwaito.
I mean, it's also interesting because you spoke earlier about like looking at Arthur and looking at us as consumers of the music being complacent, right? Because I remember reading the chapter that speaks about the song Model C. And you know, like, I was sitting back and I was like, actually,
it's very problematic.
I never actually realized when I was listening to that song so many years ago that this is what they were saying about the song, right? But now that and this is what I love about the book, right? I love like this critical engagement with the songs to be like, actually, we were problematic. Because we were also like, oh, humanati, while we were listening to someone basically saying you're too expensive, you want pizzas and you want all that. As if women can't be sexual without it being for men, right? So these women were, oh, you're too expensive for men. Actually, in any case, so I can't even afford your lifestyle. But also the idea that, like, you know, having been, or we all know we're called X Model C people, knowing how problematic the term itself Model C is, right? So saying like, oh, banabari bita di coconut. So it's not only the sexism, right? And the patriarchy, but it also the anti-blackness that comes with it, about the fact that...
And there's also a lot of classism in immigrants as well, you know? I think also part of the reason why at the time where songs like that were out, that we didn't really reckon with what they meant to us, is because historically party music in South Africa has not been seen, or people have not wanted to see party music as political. Whereas in fact the reality is black people in a partying context is very political. So you have a Hugh Masekela talking about Kauleza. He's talking about black people together having a good time, enjoying themselves, and then being disrupted, you know, by the police. So party music in South Africa has a very political history, and I think a lot of people sort of, especially with Kwaito at its height, it was more just about, hey, let's have fun, let's enjoy this, but there wasn't really a critical engagement with some of the contents of what is in those songs. And I think that's what we try and sort of do in this book, to sort of bring that that context into the music.
Speaking of transcending, you have a chapter where you go and you meet up with some of your favorite, you know, Kwaito artists, and we realize sort of the reckoning that people have had to do with their fame and their fall from grace. And the chapter that you have with Mapaputi is particularly poignant, you know, because you, I mean, we all remember that the hit songs and how big Mapaputi was at the time that he was big, right? And very often we only see the fall from fame at the end when artists have passed on and we're all being asked to donate to their accounts you know. What was the most difficult thing about interviewing somebody that you deeply admired, but also having to come to terms with just how badly they've fallen, you know, from sort of the public eye, and how different Kwaito artists have dealt with that? Because I mean, you sort of give us a spectrum, you know. So you see how Mapaputi is dealing with his sort of fall from fame and the fact that he's not as big as he used to be. Then you see,
in contrast to Kabelo,
you know,
Kabelo has just been like, I'm in the church. I love training.
Makesh has not also had the greatest time, and it's sort of interesting to track the careers of these stars. What have you found personally out of all of those sort of interactions?
I think for me, I'm very interested in the idea of what happens when the thing you're best known for comes to an end. And for me, it was important to, again, like you say, to get that full spectrum of there are people who are completely okay with this coming to an end, and there are people whose identity is rooted in this fame and what they were able to attain, that letting go of it seems almost impossible. So for me, I mean, interviewing Mapaputsi was particularly interesting because we went to a couple of shows of his, and it was more than one interview, so we got to know each other a little bit better, you know. And initially, he was very reluctant to participate in this process. But, you know, with some finessing and sort of explaining what we're trying to do. But also the other difficult thing is that a lot of Kwaito artists want to be editors in a kind of way. Mm. So they want to control the narrative of the book. So being able to get the content and speak to him and engage with him without him knowing exactly where the story was going was a particular challenge. But I also think for me, the biggest realization was just coming to terms with the fact that this is going to be a cycle. A lot of the trends that, you know, when I saw when I was speaking to my papus when he was talking about his career, I see in a lot of younger artists. I always say the music industry is designed to keep the artist in debt. So for me, that was the saddest thing, just being able to see that this is probably not going to be the last time we hear the story.
I mean, that's really intense, right? To know that for some of these people, we still listen to this music. You know, one thing that I particularly enjoyed about reading the book was the pausing, right? And going back and be like, oh my gosh, Minona, yes, oh wow, speaking. And also, like, I was reading it to my housemate, and I was reading the part where, you know, Mandla Spikiri speaks about, you know, the girl and where Uma Lebo Mathosa was singing their names in the song.
Yeah.
And my first, yes, that is true. That's what she was doing. So we had to listen to the song to her her saying, Tyrant, you know.
Honestly,
a lot of people actually didn't know that lyric. I mean,
no,
I was actually surprised.
Because
remember,
it was trending a while ago on Twitter, like maybe a few years ago, and everyone was like, things we want to know, what Lebo was saying on that song.
Yeah.
And when I read the book, I'm like, damn, that's exactly what you're saying. And
the funny thing is, once you read it, you can't unhear it after. You're like, how have I not known this for so many years?
It was also very, I think we often don't get to have intimate accounts of, or to get a human side of Kwaito artists, right?
Yeah.
Just because of things and themes that you explore in the book, you know, how Kwaito music is seen as sort of music for people that are unpolished, or it's urban music, it's music of the ghetto, right? And you then speak to Spikir, who says he still doesn't wear flashy labels, he doesn't want to appear flashy. And I thought that was an interesting way to look at the different identities that Kwaito artists have to inhabit, right? Because there's a certain sort of lifestyle and a population group that it's seen to be targeted for.
Yeah.
And even if you are a successful Kwaito artist and you're living well and you're moving on, you still need to be seen to be in touch with the masses. And I think that's a recurring narrative for almost a lot of successful Black people, right? That the first criticism will be that, he's not in touch with the people. So you need to do well, but not so well that your original, you know, target market doesn't relate. And I just wanted your thoughts on that particular interaction.
It was really interesting interviewing a lot of Kwaito artists and speaking about life in the township and this township music, but doing it in the suburbs. I think a lot of the big question is always around authenticity. So, I mean, even Spikiri, he goes on to say that he feels like he cannot be authentic unless he has those township experiences. But also for me, there's a big contradiction in that we want people to be successful in order to move out of the ghetto, to move out of the township. And then once they do, you then become faulted and people say, oh no, like you said, you're a model, so you're a coconut, you've forgotten about us, you're inauthentic and all of those things. So there's always this contradiction that exists, especially for artists. And I think for someone like Mandoza, really for me, embodies that, because he moves out of the township, he's wealthy, and his subject matter changes, and then he starts to lose a lot of his fan base. And then he goes back to it, to his original, some of his original subject matter, and people say, but you're not being authentic. You know, so there's always that criticism of, you're outside of us, so you can't really speak about us. So for me, that's one of the
I mean, it's interesting to speak about Mandoza, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, some of us could say, like, he did change his fan base because Nkalakata became a white music. We were like, we don't even listen to Nkalakata anymore because, you know, you hear it on, like, I remember hearing it on, I think it was an American or a UK series, Skins, where it was playing. I was like, we've lost it. Yeah. If it's there, we've lost it. Mm. But it's interesting. The chapter about Mandoza particularly was really heartbreaking, but also very, like, important to speak about, like, we tend to not humanize these people. Mm. And we think that they are, you know, infallible. So these people will not die. They will live for centuries.
Yeah.
And Mandoza's story, like, you're talking about, like, going to the memorial service. Yeah, yeah. And how is that for you? Like, the reckoning of, like, wow, you know what? Actually, we are fallible.
For me, two things came out of that. Because I always say I'm a person who's very fearful of death because I feel like I don't have a strong spiritual life. So that's always something that it's been a long-term battle for me. And originally when I wanted to do that story, I thought I was just going to cover the funeral. And I really wasn't sure what the story was going to come out of that. And the essay emerged in the way that it did. And then the other thing for me is just this idea of the end of an era. Mm. You know, it really felt like something. When he died, you know, we've had Brown Dash We Love pass away, we've had Abozom, we've had all of those people, but Mandoza felt like it was a bit different. Mm. It was the end of something. And it also just gave me more impetus to be able to write this book because I felt like a lot of people who I would have loved to interview and speak to this book and this is a conversation Essie and I were also having weren't around. So it was important for us to document the experiences and the stories of the people that still were. That's what we came out of that. And like you say, a lot of people, we regard them as icons and we love them, but we don't really know what the kind of demons that they deal with outside of the music. Mm.
That they're actually people.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the story of Mandoza, you know, hearing about how he was in hospital and how he couldn't see, but he still wanted to perform and do shows, it just really gave a more human side to, you know, this larger-than-life figure who did Nkalakata, who could do Nkalakata 10 times and people will still go crazy, you know. So it's always very important also to humanize people because I feel like at the moment we don't do that, we start projecting things onto them. Mm. Yeah.
Speaking of humanizing people, I'm very interested in the way that the woman in the book were reported on, you know. So one thing that particularly stood out was when you speak about Brenda Fassie and how Chikotwala owns 90% of her music, and you wonder how this woman who is in so many ways just seen to be this feminist icon, even if we're just projecting our feminism onto her, she hadn't come out and said that she was a feminist, but we just saw this woman who we thought had agency and thought that she had her own sort of place, you know, and you then see the ways in which, like, this hyper-masculinity continues to affect black women, even the ones that you think of as feminist icons and as of being excluded from the narrative.
Yeah.
Why did you guys think that it was particularly important to include this story and that narrative?
Well, Brenda, if you listen to Brenda's music, she is sort of the ancestor that connects bubblegum music and Kwaito. So she is that bridge. Mm. I mean, if you listen to an album like Imali, it has a very progressive Kwaito sound, but it's done by this person who's known for making township bubblegum pop music. So Brenda is a very important figure in the development of Kwaito music. It was important to tell that story because I think it contextualized a lot of what followed after her.
Mm.
So you have someone like Alira, for instance, you know, who goes to 999, who writes all of these songs, but then doesn't get paid for them. You have someone like a Queen, you have someone like a Nesta, you have all of these
purity.
Women. Yeah, Purity. I mean, you have all of these people that follow after Brenda who are inspired by Brenda's work, but who also fall victim to the same affliction of not owning their work. And not only not owning their work, but not being given the option to own their work. I mean, if you get into a deal, unfortunately, a lot of people, they get into these contracts because they don't really have any other options or any other means. So you sign all of your rights away. Some people are signing lifetime contracts. So even if today I make a playlist for this book, Bonsukwaito, on Apple Music, and people stream it a million times, some of the people that wrote on that song and that sing on that song won't get a cent from it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to sort of show the importance of ownership,
mm-hmm.
And how it was taken away from people,
mm-hmm.
Regardless of how creative or how important they were. The music industry always find a way to sort of pat that down, mm-hmm. and say, we own you. And I feel like this is particularly true for black artists,
mm-hmm.
you know. You don't see that in the Afrikaans soki dance music scene, you know. So with black artists, they're always put into these situations where you cannot get out.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the woman and their identities, I thought it was very interesting. Nhlokonolo and I often talk about how black women are forced to be one or the other,
mm.
you know. So they were not allowed a full spectrum of identity.
Yeah.
So you are either going to be the Madonna or, you know, you're not. And I thought it was so interesting that you talked about that in the book, how Lebo Mathosa was being compared to Thandiswa, and
yeah.
there were all of these contrasts being drawn, because it often makes me think of what we find acceptable as a society, why we struggle with the Zodwa Wabantu,
yeah.
who also gets a shout out in the book. And I really enjoyed that, right? That you spoke about that, because it's a real thing. I mean, now that Lebo has passed, people want to speak very warmly of
yeah,
her, which is
yeah.
great, but it's not in keeping with the behavior that was consistent for a lot of her career.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think to add to that, one of the other things that happens, especially in the genre of Kwaito, that happened in the genre of Kwaito, was that a lot of women were pitted against each other,
mm-hmm.
in a way that men...
I mean, it's still
that's
like
exactly,
today,
that's
right?
exactly what
yeah.
it is, right?
So in order to market a Lebo Mathosa, we must pit her up against a Thandiswa Mazwai or a Queen.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't do that for men. And again, it goes back to this idea of we don't allow women a full spectrum of identity, because
mm.
you want to put them in this box of you are a female musician.
Mm.
This is where you should navigate. You mustn't move outside of this.
Mm.
Because once you do that, you know, you challenge a lot of conventions and a lot of what people think of, women are capable of doing, especially in the music space.
We're taking a short break.
Are you a Caribbean American? Are you looking for a podcast that truly speaks to your culture and identity? Look no further than Carry On Friends, the ultimate destination for all things Caribbean American, hosted by me, Carrie Ann. Dive deep into topics such as culture, heritage, and everyday life through the unique lens of the Caribbean American experience. You'll walk away feeling more connected to your roots. Follow and listen on Apple Podcasts so you'll never miss an episode of Carry On Friends, the Caribbean American experience. Your Caribbean American community awaits.
Speaking of challenging conventions, one of my favorite shows ever, like ever, is profiled in the book. So you talk about Yizo and...
Yeah.
I don't think there's any
Baba Action. Always when I hear Yizo, I just think of Baba Action. Like,
and
Chester.
I was like, Yizo, the return. So
yeah.
I watched the full, like, from season 1 to season 3. I
yeah.
don't know if that was a good idea to allow your primary school child to watch Yizo.
I think it was.
I mean, retrospectively, I do think it was. But I also remember wanting to watch Yizo because everybody was talking about Yizo. And all
yeah.
the older kids as well, right?
Yeah.
So you
Guys.
Get into the transports, because we are transport children.
Yeah.
And like, I mean,
we weren't dropped off. We were transport children.
Yeah.
And you get into the transport and people would be like, yeah,
did you see it?
Did you see it? But it's such an interesting interplay between music at the time. So Kwaito was at its height, you
yeah.
know, when Yizo first came out.
Yeah.
There's a literal soundtrack that everybody can remember, like Uzola coming out and Yizo as well. And I'd like you to just delve into Yizo and why you thought... I don't think that Yizo has really been given the credit that it deserves, you know
yeah.
what I mean? Yizo had a gay storyline... It was way ahead of its
yeah,
time,
yeah.
you know?
I think with Yizo for me, it was an interesting show because, for one, as a young person, I felt like it was the first authentic depiction of black male friendships
mm.
that I'd seen on South African television.
Mm.
When I saw the characters on the show, I was like, oh, those are people I recognize.
Yeah.
That's so-and-so. And that's one part of it. But I think also the influence of Yuzo, I mean, it stretches beyond just that one show. Mm-hmm. Without Yuzo, you don't have a Gazlam, you don't have a Cha-Cha, you don't have these shows that really speak about township life in the late 90s and early 2000s.
Zone 14.
You don't have,
Zone 14, yeah.
But also, I mean, a lot of people don't know, there's a very big American show, a very famous show called The Wire.
Yes. Mm.
So David Simon actually came to South Africa during the making of Yuzo, and that's where he was, when he was still researching The Wire, and he thought, this is the kind of show that I want to make for America.
Mm.
So he actually was inspired by Yuzo to make The Wire. So that just shows how impactful and influential that show is. But for me, I think Yuzo did something really unique in that it gave us a view of how a community is impacted when its institutions collapse.
Yes.
When you can't trust the police,
yeah.
when children can't go to school because there's no infrastructure in which to learn.
When teachers are sexually harassing
harassing people, and more, you try and you report it and you go to the police and they'll tell you, oh no, this didn't happen.
Mm.
It doesn't get investigated, nothing happened. So it really showed sort of the difficulties of living in a post-94 South Africa and exiting that Rainbow Nation moment dealing with the realities of, whoa,
but I think
this isn't going according to plan.
It was a shattering of that.
Yeah.
And for me, it also speaks to shattering this respectability that post-94 black communities had wanted to uphold, right?
Yeah.
That it's okay, we're keeping things going, the country is not metaphorically going to the dogs, you know, just because we're in power. And I think a lot of the uproar around Yuzo was us having to confront our own feelings about respectability and seeing our communities being shown on the screen for what they were. Like,
Yuzo was a big thing. I remember there was even a debate in parliament about whether Yuzo should be shut down because it was creating like this negative depiction of what South Africa is like.
But it's not negative, right?
For me,
what I'm thinking about is like, that was what was happening in our communities.
Yeah.
But even that, like, to think about Yuzo now, right? And how the things that are happening in Yuzo are still happening today.
Yeah, even more so. I mean, I always say that Yuzo was like sort of a warning signal about what was starting to happen.
Mm.
I mean, right now, I mean, you still have people that are protesting the lack of infrastructure in South Africa.
You still have principals sleeping with children.
I still have children dying at schools.
Yeah, like
dying
it's just
at
so
schools.
All of those things. I mean, the drugs entering the school system, and untrustworthy justice and police system. All of those things that are in that show are happening, are reality in South Africa now.
And like you said, more rife, right? Like,
yeah.
Like more rife now. I mean, also an interesting conversation to have is, this may be an unfair question to ask you because you're such a consumer of Kwaito, right?
Yeah.
So one, like, what do you think for you personally is like the epitome of Kwaito music? So there's that one song, when you listen to it, you're like, you know, this is Kwaito. But then further to that, you know, you speak about TKZ and their importance, right, in the Kwaito movement.
Yeah.
But you're saying, you know, they're good, but like Uzola, because we have to speak about Zola, guys. Like, you know, the one line that I'll never forget is like, you know, don't go to Lunga Kalipi, Sulisenyembezi. It's like, it's just playing in my head. So, so what song for you is like Kwaito, but also like, what does Zola mean to you as well?
I'll answer this question in two ways. There is a song which I think, if a person walked into the room and said, what is Kwaito? And I would play that song, and I think they would get it. And I think that is Makgasma. For me, it's a perfect production. Lebo Mathosa's vocals, a low timbre tone. Just it sets the mood. Wherever you go, if you play that song, you'll know it's a vibe.
And Tom Peace, man.
Yeah,
Tom
you know, they really are like the epitome of Kwaito, you know, the whole Bantula way and everything, and they've really lived up to that image.
Mm-hmm.
But my favorite song is a song called Stars by Zola.
Yes, I'm gonna shine like the stars at Tsubu.
Yeah, for me that song, it just, you know, sometimes you find a song that hits you at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
That song for me was really speaking about the idea of community. I mean, even at the end of the song, he talks about just being grateful to everybody that makes you.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, even writing this book at the end of it, that's like, I related to that song even more, because I was looking at all the people that made this project possible, mm-hmm. and just really grateful for that.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's a song that really sort of contradicts a lot of what people think white is about, mm-hmm. which is arrogance, boastfulness, you know, and crass partying and all of these things. It's just a really beautiful song. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's. You wanted to know about Zola. Mm-hmm. I have a very interesting relationship with mm-hmm. Zola, because for me, I think he has the most perfect Kwaito albums. The trilogy of Ndlwembe, Ibuto, and Bambata. There's nothing like it. And for me, he has a very broad spectrum of content. So mm-hmm. he'll be dealing with the difficulties of spirituality and wanting to have a spiritual life, but he'll also be talking about, hey, I wanted to get with this girl.
Mm-hmm.
So he sort of goes the full spectrum of the human experience in a way that I feel like no other Kwaito artist can even come close to.
Mm-hmm.
But also I feel like he's been able to navigate Kwaito in a way that's very much full of integrity, you know. I think he's also one of those people. I mean, we know Zola's stories with women. For me, I never shoot him bail, because I know he also has that trash side to him, you know.
Trashy.
And you have to deal with that head on, because it also exists in his music.
Mm.
So I think he provides a fully developed sense of what is of the good and the bad that is possible within black men.
Mm.
I found TKZ interesting, right? Because, I mean, we have this sort of thing that comes up in the book where people are like, Kwaito is music for my fail pop, you know?
Yeah.
It's a departure point, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it initially it just wasn't cool to be like, yeah, friend, I'm listening to Kwaito, what's where? And then you talk about TKZ and how I think that there are contrasts in the sense that these are three boys who come from grade schools.
Yeah.
I mean, they're able to navigate certain lives. You interview Gabelo. Gabelo's coming from the gym, a 2-hour session.
In Santa.
And it's such a complete contrast. And for me, it also calls into question this monolithic idea that we have of blackness as a culture, of an urban culture, right?
Yeah.
That we think urban culture is that boy, Ose Lokshin, who looks a certain way, who does a certain thing. And here are these three boys from the burbs, right?
Yeah.
I mean, not well from private schools, but who then still live a Lokshin. And so they have these dual identities. And they go on to be some of the greatest, to make some of the greatest music in Kwaito. But also are received a little bit differently.
Yeah.
And do you also think that's related to positioning and to locality, right? That they sound nice. So you can actually have them on your radio show, and you know you can ask him some questions in English, and it's okay for both of
like,
you.
Yeah, you know, I like the fact that you touched on that idea on that of TKZ being received very differently,
mm-hmm.
Because they were amongst the first acts to do international shows. They would go to Jamaica, they'd go to England,
mm-hmm.
because they can carry themselves, they can mm-hmm. speak, they articulate, they have very strong musical ideas which mm-hmm. they want to bring across. So they sort of meet that criteria of the respectable black,
mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that's such a complex and difficult thing to sort of navigate,
mm.
because for me, respectability politics, it just makes living difficult,
mm.
when you have to carry yourself a certain way and be respected and do things in order to be respected, you know.
Mm.
It's still sort of like you want to elevate your position in society so you can get respect from other people. But I also think this idea that people think that Kwaito music is just music from the township, from uneducated people.
Mm.
I mean, you look at the Trompis, they're all educated. They went to music schools, they went overseas before starting Trompis.
Mm.
You look at, and also this perception that Kwaito music isn't a refined genre. So you have someone like a Moses Moleleko,
mm.
who's this great pianist, but he works with TKZ and produces for them. You have someone like a Don Laga,
mm.
who is a jazz great by the time Kwaito starts, but he also works with an Oskido, you know, to develop the sound of Kalawa jazz.
Mm.
So I very much want to rail against this monolithic idea that Kwaito music is coming from people who are uneducated,
yes.
who are from the township.
Mm.
People can come from the suburbs and make this music.
Mm.
But also, to add to that, white people were also involved in the making of Kwaito music.
Yeah.
And that's something that I feel like we haven't really dealt with.
Mm.
So you have a D-Rex, you have a Gabularu, people
a
who make, yeah, you have a Lance, you have people who come outside of Kwaito music who have made some of the most defining songs or moments in Kwaito music.
Mm.
So Kwaito music isn't just this small box of black people who come from the township. It's actually wider than
it's
that.
It's a defining moment,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It's a defining moment.
I mean, it would be remiss for us as a literary podcast to not ask you, like, you know, who are some of your writers? Who are some of the people that inspire your writing? And if you could share, like, one book that you think everyone should read.
I'm a big fan of... I love essays. I think, you know, in the history of South African literature, we don't talk a lot about the brilliant essayists that we have in this country.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about historical fiction, we'll talk about children's books, we'll talk about poetry, but I don't think we talk enough about our essayists. One of my favorite writers is Ubongani Matonde, and he was someone that I spoke to a lot during the writing of this book.
He writes beautifully.
He writes with a kind of clarity and a kind of knowledge of pop culture that for me is mesmerizing at times. Further afield, I like someone like Rachel Kadzi-Gansa for the way that she's able to bridge the gap between popular culture and just the experience of being black.
I mean, speaking about Rachel, sorry, like now you've just reminded me that she writes two beautiful essays. She writes one about James Arthur Baldwin.
Yeah.
But then she writes one about the radical vision of
Toni Morrison. Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, listen here.
I like the one about James Baldwin. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Like you said,
we don't appreciate essays, right? We want our writing to be neatly packaged. So it must be non-fiction or it must be fiction. If it's non-fiction, it must be a political scandal and how you survived that or navigated that. And if it's fiction, then maybe we'll give you a little bit more of creative
room.
But we don't particularly appreciate essays, and I don't know if it's just because we like to have our ideas bite-sized, right? We don't want to have ideas and thoughts explored, you know, which is a pity, really.
And a book. This isn't a collection of essays, but it's a book that I always encourage. Well, it's two books actually. The one book I always encourage people to read is Zahidi Smith's On Beauty.
Oh, yes.
I know we talk a lot about
Mama
One Teeth. We'll talk a lot about NW, but I feel like On Beauty is like her masterpiece.
I mean, I'm gonna say White Teeth, but I appreciate On Beauty. But White Teeth for me is like
White Teeth is.
It's like Zadie.
But
like
On
Zadie.
Beauty is just On
for
Beauty
me,
is a must read.
White Teeth, I don't respond very well to. I found On Teeth to be overly poetic for me.
Okay.
I like the simplicity and the clarity of
On Beauty,
and her ability to speak about feelings that you might have and not be able to communicate in words, but you want to so badly. And just Kiki is for me is one of the greatest characters in literature. And the other book that I really enjoyed, for me it's my favorite novel, Jonathan Franzen's Freedom. It's also another book that deals a lot with relationships, but also the idea of self-assessments within relationships. I think for me it's been like a guiding text for just navigating through life.
And what is your hope for Born to Kwaito?
For me, for Born to Kwaito, I hope when people pick it up and they read it, they're able, one, to see themselves reflected more accurately through the lens of Kwaito music. I also hope that people, it inspires people to go back and look at Kwaito differently. Like you say, because sometimes we're listening to the music very passively. So I hope that it inspires a more active listening, not only about the songs and the artists that we speak about in the book, but just beyond that, active listening within hip-hop or in house music, really just being able to decode what is being said and the implications of that.
So what's next for Sihlem Tembu and Esinago?
Well, Esinago is, she actually just passed because she was quite nervous through the writing process of this book. She wasn't going to pass at UCT, so she's been doing well. So she's just completing her degree this year. I know she's quite excited about that. For me, I'm working on a couple of projects. So I'm directing a documentary about Umambo Simhlongo, which is a project that I've been developing for the last 2 years, and it's finally coming together. And then I'm working on another book, which is a biography about an artist who shall remain nameless.
So can we get the rights to the podcasting?
Yeah, you can get the rights to the podcasting of the book. You know,
the
audio version.
Yeah.
All I can say is that the biography is, the artist is within the genre of hip hop.
Okay.
So that's an interesting project, and I'm working on a comic book.
Oh, that's exciting. Yeah, we don't have a lot of comic books, you know. Kwezi has come out, and it's nice and exciting.
I mean, Mohal and Lois are doing an incredible job with Kwezi. So it's a comic book about a couple of female superheroes who work.
Oh, we need those. We deserve
some unwanted superpowers. So I hope people enjoy it. It might be coming out later this year or early next year.
Cool. Yeah. So we have a very interesting rating system on the Cheeky Natives. You know, most people give like popcorn, stars, like boring stuff, right? We know it's relevant. We're living in this country, which is South Africa, our land. Therefore,
our land.
Therefore, the Cheeky Natives have started the Land Committee, which is headed by myself and Alma as the Cheeky Natives.
Okay.
And you know, we read books and then we apportion, we give people land. Because when the land comes, just come to the Cheeky Natives and we will give you
the
title deed.
Okay.
So that you can get it. So obviously, Isinako is from
the
Eastern Cape, and you're from KZN.
Yeah.
And we thought, like, what better way to just put you at my gate? Just give you land at my gate. City, take the land. Take my gate.
Take the land.
Okay.
Do more of the important work that must be done, you know?
I'm going to market to get my land, guys.
So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
For one, writing this really thoughtful and necessary book, right? Because I think, like you said, the people who have written about it have written about it from a very academic lens, but they've also been written from a very white gaze, right?
Yeah.
So we are grateful for, you know, Thabiso Mahlape, who is the founder of Blackbird Books, for seeing the vision and for being like, yes, see, we need these necessary stories. But also for you and Esinako, because the book, for me, I feel, is really well researched. Mm. It's not a book of, oh, I just think this
my
song.
Feelings are.
But it's like you've interacted with artists. And so from the Cheeky Natives, we want to say thank you very much.
And further than that, I think it's so important to have people who look like us write our stories, right? Because it lends a certain credence to the way that our stories are told, right? So when you read this and you realize that often black art gets treated as a nicety.
Yeah.
It gets treated as, and not as a rigorous art form, you know? It doesn't get treated as quite those like, it's music, but it's not, is it class? It's not jazz, you know? But I think this book was important.
Palatable, You know, it's not like the...
This book was important because it was a really deep and thorough and critical study, you know, and I think that was very important. That was very powerful because it goes on to show that things can be relevant and they can be something of the moments and defining moments of that, but not be excluded from academia. And it's important to do that.
I like that idea that you just touched on black arts not being critiqued rigorously. I also feel like that has the impact of making black artists not know how to react to being critiqued.
Yes.
So because we don't write about them, when you want to write about them, they actually don't know how to deal with that.
You're a hater.
And you know, they'll think of you as a hater, whereas criticism is a important part of the artistic development of any creative space. So I think writing more about black artists and their work can only make the art grow.
Yeah, and I mean, just to echo that, you know, Thabiso wrote a publisher's note in this book, and she says, when I started Blackbird Books, one of the things I knew for sure was that we needed to create a platform for black people to begin, not only to unpack ourselves and our cultures, but also to begin to interrogate the cultural impact that our lived experience carry. And that truly is what this book is, right?
Yeah.
Is that as I'm saying, we have black people writing about black people, for black people, about black people, you know. What, something that I like that Toni Morrison says is like, why do we treat black literature like sociology?
Yeah,
why can't
yeah.
it be literature? So this is going to that. It's not only literature in the sense of the word, but also, I tell you, like, in a few years' time, this is going to be prescribed reading yeah. in university.
It is.
Hopefully.
It is.
Hopefully.
So thank you very much. Okay, guys, check us on, you know, another episode of the Cheeky Natives, where obviously we'll be talking books, land, and all things nice.
Also, please go out and buy this book. You can get it everywhere. Shout out to our favorite bookstore.
Bridgebooks.
Also, use our code Cheeky and get 10% off. Please don't ask the author for a copy. Don't ask for a PDF. Don't ask a friend to borrow it. What we're doing is we're creating a movement that makes it easier for black stories to get told. And to do that, we need to buy books. So buy the book, please.
Buy
don't
the
be
book,
a problem.
Man.
Don't be a problematic fave. Buy the book.
Until next time. Bye.
Bye.